This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. When Congress approved legislation related to President Lyndon Johnson's war on poverty in 1964, it helped launch about 1,000 local community action agencies that help people get out of poverty. In the La Crosse area, that agency is now known as CoolieCAP, and like many community action agencies, it's celebrating 50 years of work this year. CoolieCAP's celebration was held recently, and among those in attendance was David Bradley, the CEO of the National Community Action Foundation, which lobbies Congress to support poverty programs like CoolieCAP. WPR's John Davis interviewed CoolieCAP Executive Director Grace Jones and David Bradley during his visit to La Crosse. Bradley maintains that while poverty issues weren't mentioned in political races this fall, politicians of both parties are talking about the issue of poverty at least privately.
Republicans may raise some things in terms of accountability or results or moving people out of poverty and take some criticism for it from advocates. And yet, in private, Democrats are raising some of the same questions. So the fact that they're on the same page, but not publicly, gives me some hope that perhaps the two parties can get together and have a good discussion, lively, healthy discussion about poverty in America.
So, Grace, the most recent numbers I've found for the state of Wisconsin were from a report from Community Action in Wisconsin that suggests in 2014 that the latest census numbers show about 13% or 750,000 people are in poverty in Wisconsin. Where is Wisconsin on this and the region? Are we better off or worse than we were, have been historically?
If you go back to when the war on poverty was established, the poverty rate nationwide was about 25%, which is really terrible historically. And over the next 7 years, as the war on poverty programs kicked in, that poverty rate was knocked in half. We didn't see it skyrocket as far as it did until the 2008 recession, when even locally in La Crosse, the poverty rate was up around 17%. Locally now, it's back around 10 to 13%, although in our rural communities, some of the childhood poverty rates are still quite shocking. So, for example, in Vernon County, childhood poverty rate, around 25%. So there's still that persistent problem in the rural communities. I think in the last year or so, things are looking up. There's been some increase in wages, some reduction in poverty rates, but I would say for low and moderate income people, we're still climbing out of that recession.
This is for both of you, really. When President Johnson declared the war on poverty, I believe the goal was to eliminate poverty, was it not? What are some of the hurdles we've seen in the last 50 years to doing that?
On January 8th of 1964, Lyndon Johnson declared unconditional war on poverty. It marked the first time that America had declared a domestic war. And since then, we've had a war on terror, a war on crime, a war on cancer. So we're sort of used to that. But part of the problem is that when you use the phraseology, the symbolism of the word war, it conjures up victory, defeat, enemies, casualties, all sorts of words associated with war. Included in that is what are we trying to accomplish in this war on poverty? I knew Sergeant Shriver very well, and I talked to Sarge a lot about what was victory, what were you trying to do in the war on poverty, and there was a feeling that we're never going to eliminate poverty completely, but we can address its causes and effects. You know, if a low-income family or a low-income individual has problems with health, let's say, and conditions that affect their health. You may go to a doctor and be treated on that, but then they go back and they go back to the same house that might have mold, a poor substandard housing, and the problems come back, and they have to live in that housing because they don't have a job, they don't have income. We've discovered that fighting poverty is complicated, it's multifaceted, and that we're never going to achieve a nation in which 100% of its population is out of poverty. There's always going to be people in need, but we can, we can as a society and as a nation, and as these agencies as Cooley kept us, we can address the causes of poverty fairly well.
Some people, I assume, living in poverty is a cycle. I mean, families live in poverty, and it's hard to break that cycle. And some people are content to live the way they live, are they not?
You can have generational poverty, where the family has been in poverty, and it has been generation after generation. That's one part of the problem. Another part is just situational poverty. So a family's rolling along, they're doing okay. They may not be rich, but they're doing okay. They're paying their bills, they have housing, and so on. And then there's a job loss. There's a recession. A lot of people lose their jobs. They start to even lose their housing. So there are solutions for that situational poverty as well, where, and this is where we do a lot of work, where sometimes a small amount of help that is temporary can really help a family get through a rough time. You help them get back on their feet, you're never going to see them again. So that's the kind of anti-poverty work where you can be really quite effective. I think on the generational poverty problems, you can often see dysfunction, substance abuse, and other issues that human service departments and therapists and counselors end up dealing with, more so than a community action agency. But if folks are appropriate for programs that we run and are challenged by them and want to improve their lives, then we're certainly interested in helping them.
So in the 50 years of Cooley Cap, what are some of the historical changes in the way Cooley Cap, which I don't think has always been known as Cooley Cap, but how has it dealt with poverty issues from, say, the 60s? And then what are some of the more historical changes to where you are today with helping with housing and
sure.
and jobs and transportation issues? And
right. Community action agencies nationwide have to do a needs assessment every 3 years where they ask low-income people, what are your greatest needs? So we regularly do that, and we tailor our strategic planning based on that. But if you look at the kind of decades of Cooley Cap, initially, the agency was very involved in outreach and information and referral. So this is a little before my time, but there were outreach workers who went out into communities door to door, finding low-income people and helping them begin to access services so they could get jobs and improve their lives. The decade after that, we became very involved in employment and training funding. And so we were funded to help people get out of their houses, have work experiences, go back to school, get job training, and find employment. So that was over half of the agency's operation at that point. On top of that, welfare reform programs we ran. Subsequent to that, we started to get more involved in housing issues because we were hearing about the growing problem of affordable housing. Homelessness in the community was growing. So in this particular decade, we've been very involved in from homelessness to home buyer. We help people with housing in many different programs, and it's a huge part of the agency now. So we have evolved over time based on community needs and also based on resources that were available.
And David, what do you see nationally? Are the agencies across the country working on different issues depending on what part of the country they're from?
Sure. You may have needs in Fargo, North Dakota that are different than needs in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. So that's the beauty of this. It is local control. It is ground up. It's not top down. And it is every community action agency, like Cooley Cap, has all parts of the community involved with that board and direction of that agency. So if Fargo, North Dakota is addressing a need, it is a real legitimate community need, just as Pittsburgh would be doing the same.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio La Crosse. I'm John Davis. We are talking about issues related to poverty as Cooley Cap, an agency that works on poverty issues in southwestern Wisconsin, celebrates 50 years of existence. Our guests are Cooley Cap Executive Director Rhys Jones and David Bradley, the CEO of the National Community Action Foundation, based in Washington, D.C. who works with members of Congress on the issues of poverty. We touched on this briefly, David. Does it really matter who wins the elections these days when it comes to the issue of poverty?
Well, I think I think it does, number one, particularly in terms of investing in domestic needs or using domestic programs to make budget cuts. There'd be a difference in philosophy. But what is important, regardless of who's in the White House, what is important is the ability to work across party lines and a willingness to engage with the Congress, regardless of which party controls it. That is, I think, what America is crying out for, is bipartisanship, enough, stop the bickering, and let's start addressing real American needs. Whether it's education or infrastructure or even national debt or immigration reform, there's a lot of issues that are coming forward. I think it's only a matter of time, though, that poverty is going to be swept up and placed on the agenda. I truly believe history runs in cycles, and I think that we are entering a cycle now that those left out and left behind are going to have to be their concerns are going to have to be looked at and addressed.
What suggests that to you?
Well, being here in Wisconsin, let me tell you, one of the people that suggests that to me is Paul Ryan. Poverty is an issue with him. He cares about it, and he supports this program. But just as Paul Ryan may have some very specific ideas on poverty, I can also tell you House and Senate Democrats are working on poverty initiatives as well. That's number one. But number two, the private sector is really stepping forward nationwide, whether it's big corporations, small corporations, saying small companies saying, we also have to start doing something about poverty. So there is a groundswell that is building, that will continue to build, across party lines.
The political debate we are hearing regarding the economy and whether or not the lower and middle class, you know, is disappearing in this country to the super rich, you know, to the benefit of the super rich. Are we in some ways creating a new class of poverty in America or a new subset of poverty given some of the income inequality in America?
Well, I think the middle class is shrinking, and they have. I think that explains a lot of the Trump supporters, for instance, people that have the economic recovery has left them out and behind for years. They've not experienced it. So the middle class is shrinking. There's no doubt about it. And upward mobility is not a cornerstone of our economy the way it has been, and so people falling to the lower rungs of the economic ladder continues to increase. So in some sense, your question is very accurate in that as we are denying opportunity and we are creating through policies and inaction, we're creating more people that are either in poverty or one or two steps away from poverty.
So locally, the Great Rivers United Way just released the ALICE study, which was quite enlightening for a lot of people. So in my field, we know this stuff. But for the general community, I think it was an eye-opener for them to realize that when you look at the numbers of people who are in poverty or just above it, you're talking about over 40% of our general population. And I think a lot of folks don't realize how many people are what I would call on the brink of poverty, not below the poverty line, but just one crisis in their life, and they will be.
Yeah, define that, or give me an example of that, what living on the brink of poverty looks like, if you could.
Certainly a family, because of the rising cost of housing, because of stagnating wages, a lower income worker can make it, but what can throw them off course is something like a huge car repair bill or a large medical bill or a large dental bill. So that suddenly they can be thrown into crisis because they have to pay this bill, they don't have the money for it, what are the choices they make? If they pay the car bill so they can keep getting to work, they may not have the money for rent, and soon they're getting evicted and then they're homeless. So there's different paths that that story can take, but it's just that when you're living right on the edge, one minor catastrophe and you're over the edge.
And I'm kind of struck because this never used to be an issue. The amount of homeless people who are describe themselves that way and going to school, and the schools are dealing with this issue now in ways that they probably haven't traditionally had to deal with.
Right. La Crosse County has a pretty high number of homeless youth that is surprising to the community. Cooley Cap has 90 units of housing that we provide every year to families that were homeless, and so we provide them with housing, and they have to basically go to school, go to work, and work themselves out of homelessness. So there are services in the community for this, but there are quite a few homeless families.
I want to add one point to John, your question and Grace's response. The one of the tragedies in America now is the number of homeless veterans, and it's shocking. And so it's let's hope that that will be addressed.
Yeah, and this may be more for Grace, but one of the neat things that's going on in La Crosse right now is the effort to end homelessness among veterans.
Right. Our staff is involved with that and the collaboration to end homelessness. And their first target was complete elimination of homelessness for vets in the area of La Crosse County, I believe. And they will do that by the end of this year. They've identified all the homeless vets. They're working with them, and they're going to meet this goal.
And I think there are efforts to end homelessness, period, in La Crosse. Are there not?
The community brought in a gal from Brooklyn who's an expert on homelessness named Erin Healy, and she spoke to us about the cost to society of an individual who is homeless and using all the community services, suffering while doing it, remaining homeless, but whether it's the sheriff, the hospital, human services, around $65,000 a year. If you can just provide housing for that person, stabilize them, help them rebuild their life, that's $16,000 a year. So it just makes sense to provide some investment in helping these folks get off the streets, stabilize their lives, and get back to work, and so on.
And David, stories like that, are they going on across the country?
Yeah, absolutely. And it that's what makes the job and what I've devoted my professional life to so rewarding, is that in virtually every community, there are thousands and thousands of individuals and families who have a chance for opportunity, a chance for success, a chance to make a decent life for himself or herself because of the efforts of these agencies.
So how much of the federal budget is devoted to fighting poverty now, would you say? And does that need to increase?
It's about 1%. When President Johnson proposed it, it was about he wanted 1% of that. But it gets complicated in that how much goes for entitlements versus how much goes what we call discretionary spending, domestic discretionary, to help fund agencies who are front line on devising strategies, approaches, programs designed to lift people out of poverty. It's one thing to give somebody a check and say, you know, we'll pay your utility bill or we'll do this or do that for you. But it's another thing, and I think as important, if not more so, to work with that family and individual and develop a plan on moving them out of poverty, giving them an opportunity, make them self-sufficient. So on that last part, breaking down how much we're spending on poverty in America or the government is spending on addressing poverty, the entitlement side far outweighs the small discretionary side. And that has to be part of the debate about investing in successful community programs.
Issues like Social Security and
Medicare. Medicaid.
Yeah.
I learned an interesting fact the other day that if you remove Social Security for senior citizens in America right now, their poverty rate would jump from, I think now, about 9% to about 50%. So this is an example of Social Security is an investment. It is with taxpayers' dollars, but it actually reduces the poverty rate from what would have been 50% to 9% for senior citizens. So when you think about tough choices and what needs to be cut, I think that's the kind of fact we need to keep in mind.
We've been doing a series of shows this year, a monthly series, looking at issues relating to an aging population over the next 20 years or so. And a couple of the programs I've been struck, really shocked by the most, have dealt with the conditions that seniors are living in with housing right now, and also kind of the economics, their ability to save money for the future and retirement and that type of thing. And both painted a fairly bleak picture of the current senior population, not even adding that baby boomer aging over the next 20 years to the scene. Is that on the minds of people who fight poverty? Because that is coming in a hurry.
We've actually written a paper about this, which is on our website. There is a looming crisis. It has, just in terms of baby boomers who have not made enough to be able to save to retire. And the average amount of savings is really quite low. They've had no pensions or retirement plans, and they're going to be retiring from the baby boomer generation. So a lot of folks are headed for trouble once they retire.
And how do you deal with that?
I would say, number one, be careful about eliminating Social Security, because that's going to be what they're all living on, a lot of them.
David, well, has that become an issue across the country?
Aging baby boomers facing either financial insecurity, and because of that, staying in the workforce longer, which complicates a robust economy. And we're in a cycle right now, and whether it lasts for 10 or 20 years, when low GDP growth, 1.5% or so, might be the norm. So we're not going to create a booming, so far we're not in the last few years creating a booming economy quite the way we wanted to. And it really complicates lives of those low-income individuals or those teetering on poverty. And I think forces many to perhaps work longer than they should, denying job openings for others. Gets very, very complicated. So it is an issue, but as in all aspects of poverty, it's not an easy sort of postage stamp kind of an answer. It's complicated on the aspects.
What do you think we need more of to fight poverty in this country? Is it money? Is it is the solution?
I don't think it is money. I think it is, first of all, I think it's leadership. And that is, we're committed to addressing poverty, have a good discussion on it. I think that needs to happen, number one. Number two, we've got a $3.4, $3.5 trillion budget. So we're not arguing for double the budget, federal budget, double the budget size. But we are saying there ought to be a good policy debate by both parties in the best tradition of American public life about what's the best ways to address poverty and what works and what doesn't. And that needs to be a fair debate on both sides. Number three, I think that there is a tremendous need for the private sector to re-up their involvement and their commitment. And whether it is big business, whether it's universities, just to enlarge the troops out there. And then fourth, one of the things that I think the war on poverty is not given enough credit for, and what Johnson and my mentor, Sergeant Shriver, did, was that in 1964 and 65, and Cooley Cap started in 1966, by the very action of starting that agency locally, it said to the four counties they serve, no longer can you ignore the poverty in your midst. We need that awareness again. We need people to feel in their subconscious and in their moral fiber that it's not right to have someone
who is suffering or denied opportunities the way this society has.
Grace?
And obviously David is just so eloquent on this, and that's why he's our national leader on poverty issues. But I wanted to pick up on one thing he mentioned about the private sector, because what we're seeing locally is there's a labor shortage. Employers are acutely aware of this. There are many jobs that are going unfilled, many jobs. And there's the Seven Rivers Alliance just started what was called the WISE Project, where we're going to be studying how do we help the people that are left in the labor pool, who have been left behind, who need skills training and assistance to get into those jobs that are now available that they're not equipped for now. So the employers have an imperative to really get involved on this issue. They have a labor shortage, and we would like to help the people that could work for them get there.
I don't mean to suggest that fighting at the war on poverty is strictly an issue for the federal government. I mean, your budget includes state and local support, and as well as private sector support.
Right.
Does it not? And how is that compared today to historically when Cooley Cap started? I mean, was it strictly federal back when it started?
Federal and state. We were primarily government funded for a long time, so federal, state, county contracts. I would say about 15 years ago, we started to expand into fundraising, and so have been the recipient of funds from the La Crosse Community Foundation, the Bremer Foundation, the Great Rivers United Way. So we've increasingly accessed local funds from those organizations, also from private donors. What's great about that is that the local money can serve as matching funds for other monies. And so, for example, for our homeless program, for every dollar that's donated locally, we can leverage $4 out of HUD and have $5 to work with helping a homeless family. So that local match is crucial. We can't access the other money without it, and we're ever so grateful for everybody that donates locally.
Grace Jones is the executive director of Cooley Cap, a community action agency based in Westby that works to reduce poverty in the region. David Bradley is CEO of the National Community Action Foundation based in Washington, D.C., which works on issues related to poverty at the national level. Cooley Cap is one of many community action agencies celebrating their 50th anniversary in 2016. They were interviewed by WPR's John Davis. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Coming up, we'll talk to the author of the book, Lies My Teacher Told Me, Dr. James Lowen. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Hope Kerwin. When Dr. James Lowen wrote the book Lies My Teacher Told Me in the 1990s, it served as a lesson that just because something is written in a textbook doesn't necessarily mean it's an accurate depiction of what happened. Lowen spoke with a variety of groups during a recent trip to La Crosse, including current and future educators.
I suppose my overall message is the way we learned U.S. history in high school was terrible. We learned all kinds of things that didn't happen. We didn't learn all kinds of important things that did happen. And as a result, we're kind of stupid. And we're stupid in how we think about the United States, how we think about the present. So the reason that I am so interested in the past, I'm not a historian by trade, I'm a sociologist, but I have found that what we mislearn about the past has intense relevance to how we think about the present and what we get wrong about the now.
Can you give an example of how misinformation about the past has come back to influence
Sure.
us?
Sure. In fact, this example will be from one of the things I'm going to be talking about on campus. If you ask Americans, why did we have a civil war? Of course, they say, well, we had a civil war because the South seceded, and that's correct. So then if you ask, well, why did the South secede? You always get four answers. You get the answers that South seceded for slavery, seceded for states' rights, seceded because of the election of Lincoln, and seceded over tariffs and taxes, issues about that. And then if you ask them to vote, typically, and I've done this in Wisconsin, I've done it in Florida, and every point in between, Southern California, North Dakota, 65% of most audiences, including 65% of K-12 teachers who are teaching American history, say the South seceded for states' rights. Now, that's completely wrong, just totally wrong. In fact, the South seceded against states' rights. They were upset about states' rights. They were mad about various northern states, including Wisconsin, and things they had done. And they're happy as a clam with the federal government under Buchanan and were not seceding because of anything the federal government had done. Now, does that make a difference today? Well, you betcha, because one of the reasons we have all these Confederate monuments everywhere, and we have a college named Calhoun College at Yale, named for John C. Calhoun, famous secessionist theorizer, is because the Confederacy enjoys such a wonderful reputation. I mean, anybody who's ever had any trouble with the IRS can kind of sympathize with states' rights. So that's an example, then, of a lie, actually. It's so 180 degrees wrong, we have to call it that, that comes from about 1890 that is messing with our minds in 2016.
And so, you know, your book, Lies My Teacher Told Me, it reviewed a number of different history textbooks. And, you know, these are all from different, you know, publishers. And how did these, you know, inaccuracies or misinformation about our past...
Mm-hmm. How'd they get in there?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the first thing you have to realize, and I actually proved this when I was writing the second edition of Lies My Teacher Told Me, the books are not written by their authors. Now, you might say, Lauren, wait a minute. Aren't authors the one who writes the book? No. They rent those names, famous historians. But we don't know who writes the books. And I prove this partly because Prentice Hall, in their infinite wisdom, trying to save a dime, instead of hiring one hack to write the revised edition of a book allegedly by Burston and Kelly. Now, Daniel Burston is a librarian of Congress, very famous historian, won the Pulitzer Prize twice. Brooks Mather Kelly, chief archivist at Yale, they didn't write their book. They hired a hack to write the book. But instead of hiring a different hack to write this other book called Pathways to the Present, which is allegedly by four professors, most of them at Miami University of Ohio, they used the same hack twice. And so the last chapter of the book, where for the new edition, reads the same for page after page, or maybe one of the paragraphs has the word very in it. It went through different copy editing maybe, but they hired the same guy twice. So I managed to actually discover this, and it's interesting that I discovered it. What this shows is that in all these school districts that adopt books, in all these states that adopt books statewide, like famously Texas, nobody actually reads the books, because if they had, they would have discovered just what I had, that two of the books were identical for most of a whole chapter. But I discovered it. Well, I got a front page article in the New York Times out of it, and the authors wound up with egg on their face, but nothing else happened to them. You know, nobody cares what happens to a textbook. The American Historical Association doesn't even review them.
And so you mentioned this earlier of, you know, this idea that, you know, we need to understand our history to, you know, be able to move forward successfully in the future. You know, and kind of what are the dangers of not knowing our history?
Well, the first problem is we don't think causally. In the textbooks, the way they present history is just one damn thing after another. It's not clear how A causes B, B causes C. If we just think about race relations, which is something we're going to be talking about today in La Crosse, how did La Crosse become so white? Most Wisconsin towns had larger black populations in 1890 than they did by 1940. And this is completely unnatural. I mean, the black population of the United States starts out mostly, of course, in the southern states, enslaved. And then as soon as slavery breaks down around 1863 to 1865, black folks start going everywhere. And they wind up in every county in Montana, for instance, except one. They wind up in every county in Indiana, except one. They wind up across the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And then, after 1890, they unwind up. That is, they retreat from all of these places, and something bad happens. Well, the textbooks can never help us deal with anything that's going retrograde, that's getting worse, because their basic storyline is, we started out great and we've been getting better ever since. And if anything goes in the opposite direction, and things do sometimes, then they can't think about why. They won't even tell us that it went in the opposite direction. So that's an example, again, of how we just don't think right about the present because of the way we've been taught about the past.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Today we're talking with Dr. James Loewen, an award-winning historian and sociologist who studied the misinformation that's often taught in American history and why knowing our past is so important. And so you mentioned earlier that, you know, you're a sociologist by trade, but how did you get interested in looking at, American history?
First of all, I have to say the world, of course, doesn't come divided up into sociology and history and poli-sci and so on. My doctoral dissertation, for instance, was called The Mississippi Chinese Between Black and White, and I studied this unusual third race in a system built for two from about 1868 till about 1968 when I was writing the book. So is that history? Well, yes. Is that sociology? Well, yes. You know, it's even poli-sci in some ways. But so that's the first point. But the second point I would say is I got so interested in history, which is, of course, what we tell ourselves about the past, from my first full-time teaching job. And that was at Tougaloo College. That's a black college in Mississippi, right next to Jackson, Mississippi. And I taught there for 7 years. And my first year there, I was teaching the courses I expected to be teaching in sociology, but I was also asked to teach one section of a course called the Freshman Social Science Seminar, which introduced students to sociology, of course, and poli-sci, econ, psych, and so on. It was invented by the history department, and it was done in the context of African-American history. It made sense, 99% of our students being African-American. Well, so second semester begins right after Christmas, but it also begins right after the Civil War in that context. So I didn't want to do all the talking that first day of class, so I asked my students, okay, what happened during Reconstruction? That's, of course, the period right after the Civil War. And what images do you have? And my students said, 16 out of 17 of them said, well, that was the period right after the Civil War when blacks took over the government of the southern states, but they were too soon out of slavery, and so they screwed up, and white folks had to take control again. Now, there are at least three, probably four, direct lies in that sentence. Blacks never took over the government of the southern states. The southern states' governments during Reconstruction did not screw up. They did all kinds of various interesting things. They passed the best state constitutions that the southern states have ever had. They started the public school system for both races. Mississippi in particular had better government during Reconstruction than at any later point in the 19th century. And so, therefore, whites didn't take control at the end of Reconstruction. A certain group of whites, white racist Democrats using KKK tactics, indeed it was, of course, the original Ku Klux Klan, they took over. So I'm saying to myself, my God, what must it do to you to believe that the one time your group was center stage in American history, they screwed up? For that matter, what does it do to white folks? You know, ninth grade white folks who learn the one time those black folks took over is terrible. So it makes everybody more anti-black, if you will. So I went to nearby schools to see this happening. How could this happen? Tougaloo's a very good college. My students were good students. They were learning. I watched as a black teacher taught an all-black class. This white supremacist, we call it BS in sociology. That means bad sociology. Because he was just teaching what was in the book. So that taught me that history can be a weapon, that it can be used against you, and that it had been used against my students. And when I then went from I claim I went from the blackest college in America to the whitest college in America because I wound up at the University of Vermont. And I found that my students, again, in white Vermont, had learned the damnedest things that didn't happen in the past and didn't know the most important things that did happen. And so I realized Mississippi exemplified this problem in a more exaggerated form, as Mississippi exemplified lots of things in the 1970s and 80s in a more exaggerated form. But this was a national problem. So that's why I've been interested in history ever since.
You know, over the past year, maybe two, we have seen, you know, increasing tensions between the African American community and, you know, police in our country. And just, you know, racial inequality has really come to the forefront of things. You know, do you think that our history or our lack of understanding about our history is really, you know, kind of feeding the racial inequality and the tensions that we're seeing today?
Sure, I think it's part of it. I will say this. I'm an optimist. I'm encouraged by the tension. I think we have several movements going on today that are positive. One of them is the anti-Confederate movement. I mean, literally, until a guy named Dylan Storm Roof murdered 9 African-American parishioners at a church in Charleston, I guess by now a year and a half ago, until then, the Confederacy and lies about the Confederacy still held forth and held a privileged position in American society, North as well as South. And you get these astounding things like Calhoun College at Yale University. Calhoun College is a dormitory. They use the term college where any normal school would use the term dormitory. But they named this college, this dormitory, for John C. Calhoun in about 1935. Now, that's an astounding thing to do if you learn what John C. Calhoun stood for and what he did. He was the architect of secession. He provided the intellectual framework for secession on behalf of white supremacy. He also provided the framework for the intellectual framework for slavery. Of course, slavery had been going on. And we name a building for him, an important building, at Yale University in 1935. Why in the world would we do that? Why do we have Jefferson Davis Highway that starts at the border of Washington, D.C., goes down through Virginia all the way to Mississippi, then it goes clear over to San Diego, comes up through Seattle, and ends at the Canadian border? It's the longest named highway in the United States. Named why? I mean, what are we naming, what are we honoring when we honor Jefferson Davis? We are not honoring his service as Secretary of War, I think it was, under Buchanan. We're not honoring that he was a really good senator. No, we are honoring him because, of course, he led secession, treason, on behalf of slavery, okay? In other words, because he was the leader of the Confederacy. So the fact that we now have an anti-Confederate movement, that we have a Black Lives Matter movement that is questioning police behavior, we've had bad police behavior in places by people, not by all police, of course, since the slavery patrol days in 1619 or so and until now. But now, with cell phones and with the intellectual movement going on, we're questioning it. So more power to these movements.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Today we're talking with Dr. James Lowen, an award-winning author who studied the misinformation that's often taught in American history and why knowing our past is so important. And so, you know, you've talked about how, you know, we need to rethink the way that we often teach American history. But do you think broader curriculum reform is needed in the education system?
Well, I think that history stands out as the worst taught subject. And there's some, I'm a sociologist. We try to use evidence for this rather than just I think. So let me give you a couple of pieces of evidence. Sometimes I hold up my bestseller, Lies My Teacher Told Me, and say, I could have subtitled this book, Revenge Against Coach DeMolin. Because Coach DeMolin, the basketball coach, was my history teacher in Decatur, Illinois, right in the middle of Illinois. Well, there's only one field where that kind of thing goes on. Coach DeMolin would never be assigned to teach math. Everybody knows he doesn't know any math. There aren't enough PE classes for all these coaches. This is a Midwestern phenomenon, incidentally, and a Southern phenomenon, and in particular a Texas phenomenon, that we have people teaching out of field in history. In fact, 15% of the people teaching history in high schools across America never had one course in it. Now, there's no other field that can make that statement. You know, if you're an English teacher, well, in fact, you can't even graduate from college, I don't think, without having a required course in English. So we know you've had at least one course in English. If you're teaching physics, you probably majored in physics. You certainly had at least one course in physics. So I think history stands out as the worst taught course. And I think there's a second reason for that, too. And I draw that from the book titles. We have history textbooks called things like Rise of the American Nation. You can't see this on the radio, but I'm putting up my right hand because you almost have to be putting my hand over my heart. That after we lost the war in Vietnam, that book got changed to Triumph of the American Nation, The Great Republic, The Great Experiment, Land of the Free, etc. Well, we don't call books like that in geometry or American literature. The book is called Reader in American Literature. In chemistry, we don't call the book Triumph of the Molecules, you know? So there's, in other words, there's some nationalism going on. We have to kind of salute the flag while we're taking notes on our history textbook. I think history's the worst, therefore.
Is this a problem in other countries?
Yes.
Do you know?
Yes. I only read English to my soul, but I try to keep up with what's going on in other countries. And by the way, it's a big issue these days and has been for at least 15 years between China, Korea, and Japan. Each of them writing their own nationalist history, especially Japan, is the issue. Because Japan, by the time you get done reading one of Japan's approved textbooks, admittedly it's not the best one and it's used by only a very few schools, but still, China and Korea are both outraged that Japan would even approve this textbook. It basically mystifies why World War II ever happened. It mystifies that the Japanese took most of China and waged war against the whole country, you know. By the time you end up reading it, you are stupider about the past, just like some American history textbooks. So this is not unique to the United States at all. There are some places doing better, and just two to think about. Russia is one, and South Africa is another one. After the one person, one vote revolution, shall we say, in South Africa, there's these four women K-12 teachers, I think that's what they all were, wrote a book about this problem. It's called A New History for a New South Africa. And they started right off saying, you know, up until the end of white supremacy and the rule of South Africa, we emphasized the following six myths in South African history. And I'm reading these myths and say, yeah, you know, we teach about four of those ourselves. But now that's totally inappropriate. We gotta rethink this from the ground up. It's a great book. I mean, you know, we kind of need to rethink ours from the ground up, too.
People often say that history is written by the winners, whether that's, you know, the winners of a war or whatnot. Do you think that's true? And do you think that has a part in this?
I think it is true. And I think, bizarrely enough, it shows that the white Confederate South won the Civil War in 1890. Now, of course, I know it ended in 1865. I know it ended in surrender at Appomattox and then surrender in Bentonville, North Carolina, and so on. But the white, we need to call them neo-Confederates because by 1890, it's a new generation. They won it in 1890. And they won it in various ways. They won it on the ground. They won it with Confederate monuments everywhere. Confederate monuments go up between 1890 and 1940. Very few go up before 1890 because they didn't win it until 1890. You put up monuments after you win. You know, you might think about, listeners might think about the Vietnam Memorial in D.C. We lost that war, of course, and that memorial is a gash in the earth. It didn't go up. It went down, as it were. So as long as we understand that between 1890 and in some ways yesterday, the Confederates won the war, then we can say, yes, the winners write the history.
How do you think that, you know, the recording of events, the recording of you know, today's, what will become, you know, tomorrow's history, how do you think that is changing? And, you know, is it getting better?
Well, I'm hoping it is, and maybe I'm just a blind optimist, but we do have something different nowadays. It's called the web, and as a result, you can record, you know, on your Facebook page. You have one, right? On your in your Instagrams or wherever emails go when they die. I guess they go to WikiLeaks or they go to the National Security Agency. So maybe they're keeping them all. Maybe they've got a little file on Hope or on me, Jim Lowen. I certainly hope so. I wouldn't want to be left out. Anyway, I'm being a little silly about it, but we all have the capability of blogging. We all have the capability of making a website and keeping it up for a while. Now, this is an interesting problem because what's going to happen to the, you know, if you write a book, I read a book the other day that was written published in about 1872, and my copy was 1872. It's not clear that we're going to be able to blog something in 2016, and let's see, 1872, that's about 145 years later. And 145 years later, we'll be able to find our blog. You know, today's history is maybe very impermanent, so that could be a problem. But the interesting advantage of it is that it's not as gate-kept. You don't just have six high school history publishers and you have to rely on them. There's all kinds of other sources out there. So I'm an optimist about that side of it. Now, of course, that means there's all kinds of people publishing all kinds of things. I still am an optimist because I think that causes students to have to become critical readers, critical thinkers. You just can't reproduce what a KKK site says about Martin Luther King and what some other more responsible site says about Martin Luther King without noticing there's a little tension between the two sites. And you do, so the bland high school history textbooks all read alike. We've already discussed why. But the websites don't all read alike. So I think that's good, too, in that it almost forces us to be critical thinkers.
Dr. James Lowen is the author of the book Lies My Teacher Told Me, which focuses on common inaccuracies in American history and how they impact the future. And that's Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. The executive producer for Newsmakers is John Gatto, and our senior news editor and producer is John Davis. If you missed part of today's show, you can find the audio archives at wpr.org/newsmakers.